I'm delighted to welcome to the Radio Cafe Nancy Andreasen. She is a neuroscientist and psychiatrist. She's Andrew H. Wood's Chair of Psychiatry and Director of the Neuroimaging Research Center and the Mental Health Clinical Research Center at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. She will be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, the 15th of July, at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe. The lecture is called Understanding Genius, the Neuroscience of Extraordinary Creativity. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute and is free and open to the public. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Nice to be here.
So you received a PhD in literature, and then you changed direction to study medicine, and you've spent many years studying extraordinarily creative people, mental illness, and the neuroscience that helps us to understand them. What is the relationship between high creativity and mental illness?
Well, our knowledge about that is an evolving story. There are not all that many studies that have actually looked carefully at highly creative people and, you know, interviewed them personally and used reasonably standard definitions of psychopathology, making diagnoses. What we know based on studies like that is that there is definitely a relationship between creativity and mental illness. The study that I've done initially looked at 30 highly creative writers from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and they had a very high rate of mood disorder, bipolar disorder or manic depressive illness, and depression. And they had an increased rate of those problems in their family members, their first-degree relatives, parents, children, and siblings. And the first-degree relatives had an increased rate of creativity as well compared to a control group. I'm doing a second study now looking at a mixed group of artists and scientists because when I finished the first study of the workshop group, I said, is this something specific to writers or does it characterize creative people in general? So for the current study, I'm looking at people who've gotten major awards like Nobel Prizes and Pulitzer Prizes and things and doing interviewing, but I'm also doing a lot of imaging studies. And it's looking as if in that group the association is holding up as well, although not as strong as in the workshop study. So to me, those are the kind of model studies. There are other studies that have been done which have looked at people who test high on what are called creativity tests. That's, you know, from my point of view, that's not necessarily tapping into really creative people. There was a study that was just published in the last couple of weeks from a group in Iceland, and they have an enormous genetic database, and they were able to look at people who had genes that predisposed to mental illness and their occupations. So they found people who were, you know, like university professors or in fields like literature. It's a much looser definition of creativity, but they did find links between genes and creativity defined that way.
What are the similarities and differences between scientific and artistic creativity?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I've been thinking about it a lot while I've been doing this study of artists and scientists. And the initial thought is that they would be different, that scientists would be, you know, more methodical or more rational or whatever, whereas people in the arts would be more reliant, let's just say, on imagination, maybe more emotional and so on. It's not playing out that way. It's turning out that lots of people who are in the sciences have artistic interests and artistic skills and abilities, and likewise that these very successful people in the arts have some scientific skills. It's a broader group of people from the arts in this round. I mean, I've got people, one of the people in the artist group actually designed, he's the head of Imagineering at Disney, and he designed the Animal Kingdom, Walt Disney World. Naturally, to do something like that, you've got to have some kind of engineering skills in addition to imaginative skills. So I'm at a place where I'm thinking that there's a tendency for creative people to be kind of polymaths, to be good at a lot of different things, and that the stark division between art and science is a little too oversimplified.
I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking about it as I was reading one of your books about creativity, and you know, it's true that in science you can test an idea, which may have come about as the result of an intensely creative process, but you can test the idea to see if it's right. And in the arts, there's not a test, but somehow sometimes there's a kind of sense of rightness when something new is created. I wondered what your perspective was on that.
Well, I think that what you said is exactly right. I mean, think of somebody doing a painting, and depending on what they're using, oil or acrylic or whatever, they're laying on the paint, and as they do it, they are trying to decide if they need more, if they need something more at the top, more at the bottom. And when they get to the place where they think it's perfect, that's the end of their experiment with that particular painting. I just had a painter here. He was my most recent subject, and he certainly proceeded that way.
It's also interesting when you think about the arts and sciences, so many people in both areas have a sense of discovery, whereas in the arts you think, where's the discovery? It's all invention. But again, it makes you wonder in what way those things are, because when you find something in science, it's more likely to be thought of as a discovery.
You know, when a person is a writer, they have all kinds of little habits of carrying around notebooks or jotting down ideas or whatever, and in general, what happens is that the pieces that they've collected coalesce, and there is a kind of discovery when they say, aha, this is what I want the plot to be like, or aha, this is what this character is going to be like, or this is how these two characters are going to interact with one another. You read my book, and you know, it was very interesting to talk to Neil Simon, who said, you know, I don't write consciously. It just flows out of my muse. The muse sits on my shoulder. And he also said that he never knows how a play is going to end until he writes the last lines. So there is discovery going on in the process of writing.
Do you think there is a muse for scientists? Have they ever reported that kind of feeling?
Yeah. I'm working on a book right now on mostly on great physicists. I've just been doing the chapter on Michael Faraday and James Clerk Maxwell, and Faraday is especially interesting because he would have a question, he would design an experiment to test it, and then once he got the result, he would say, oh gosh, maybe the electric charge wasn't strong enough, I'll try increasing it. And he might spend an entire day varying the parameters in his experiment, and he might end up with nothing at the end of the day, it might take him a week. Or he might, at the end of the day, discover something that he was hoping to find and indeed did find. It's just very interesting to think about how a scientist like that works, because the stereotype for Faraday is that he was a great experimentalist and did not work from theories. But in fact, he would do an experiment that would suggest a theory. He'd do another experiment to test that theory, and depending on how it turned out, he would design yet another experiment. He was an amazing man in terms of what he managed to achieve.
We're talking to neuroscientist and psychiatrist Nancy Andreasen. So let's talk about the neuroscience piece of it. When you look at the brains of highly creative people versus ordinary intelligent people, what are the differences?
Well, that's still a work in progress, but it's looking as if they have more highly developed regions of the brain that we refer to as association cortex. The human brain has various specialized regions, like for vision, for hearing, for taste and smell and things like that. It has specialized regions for words, but it also has very large areas that we call association cortex, and the role of the association cortex is to take separate pieces and connect them together to make sense out of something. Just to give an example, we don't often think about what happens when we read, but when we read, what we're doing is having our eyes see a pattern on a page, that pattern goes to our visual cortex just as black and white letters or black letters on white. And that isn't reading. To read, that image of the letters has to get forwarded on to association cortex that recognizes the words as words. And then for each of us, a given word may have different connections. So if I say cat, I have an image of cats. It would be probably different from your image of cats. Well, those kinds of connections are what happens in the association cortex. And the thinking is that people who are highly creative, think of somebody like Shakespeare, they have a richer reservoir of associations in their association cortex. For Shakespeare, a word like cat might have, let's just say, 30 associative meanings, whereas for somebody else, there might be only 10 or 3 or 1. And that's why he had such rich language.
There's a quotation from Steve Jobs where he says, creativity is just connecting things. When you ask creative people how they did something, they feel a little guilty because they didn't really do it. They just saw something.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like the association piece that you're talking about.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Now, what about people with mental illness? I mean, there's this correlation between people with, for example, bipolar and mood disorders. When you look at the images from the brains of people with bipolar and mood disorders who aren't necessarily highly creative artists, do they have some of those similarities?
I don't think we have a very good answer to that question yet. The whole imaging field, I mean, it's a huge burgeoning field, but there are lots and lots and lots of compounds. And I don't know of anybody who's designed a study to ask the question, are the brains of people with, say, bipolar disorder similar to the brains of people who are creative, having you know, matched comparisons for age and gender and things like that?
I just find myself wondering about this because it's something that's been written about for far longer than we've had neuroscience, but the artist who's kind of living on the edge of madness. And I find myself wondering, you know, if we were to get very good at curing things like depression and bipolar disorder, what would happen then to the next generation of artists? Would they be happier and create less? I mean, is there something necessary about the mood thing in the creative process?
Well, you know, that's another $64,000 question. It's something I think about a lot. You've obviously thought about it too. Are we diminishing creativity by reducing the suffering from mental illness? My knee-jerk thought is that we probably are not. There is, I think, probably a link, yes, between having either schizophrenia or a mood disorder of some kind in creativity, but it's not a tight link. And the traits that make people creative are somewhat associated, because people who are creative, as I sometimes say, people who are creative can see things that other people can't. But people who are mentally ill also see things that other people can't. And, you know, when they're right, they're both mentally ill and creative. Looking at it another way, taking an example of one of America's great poets, Robert Lowell, he had terrible bipolar illness. I mean, really severe. And he, you know, was hospitalized many times. He got hours and hours of psychotherapy. And then when lithium became available, he started taking lithium. And as he said, this little pill, this little salt discovered in Denmark has reduced my episodes of manic depressive illness to almost nothing. And instead of spending a fortune financially and many hours getting psychotherapy and traveling up to McLean Hospital, I have all this free time to work on my poetry, and the poetry still continues to flow. So it's almost as if being treated made him more creative.
Very interesting. And then there's examples of the, I was reading in an article that you wrote, I think it was the mathematician John Nash, is that correct? Who, at the end of his life, was talking to people from spaceships.
Mm-hmm.
And you asked him, why do you believe that you're talking to extraterrestrials? And he said, because it's coming from the same place as my big ideas came from.
Yeah, that's actually, that wasn't my interview with him. That was one of his colleagues while he was hospitalized at McLean, and it's described in a book by Sylvia Nasser called A Beautiful Mind. But it's a very telling quotation. And by the way, John Nash is an extremely interesting example of the link between schizophrenia and creativity. And I think that link may be stronger in people in math, physics, and so on than it is in people who are in, say, literature. He just died about 2 weeks ago. After he had gotten off the plane, he'd gone to Norway to get the biggest prize you can get in math. He was flying home with his wife, Alicia. They arrived early and took a taxi to get to their home, and the taxi had an accident, and they were killed, both of them at the same time.
Oh, my goodness.
Very tragic. What I want to say about John Nash is that, very interestingly, he was very ill, but he actually essentially recovered over the course of about 30 years. And so, I mean, I know him very well, or I knew him very well. And with the help of his wife, Alicia, who was just a wonderful person, he managed to steadily become more normal. And he talked about it in his Nobel Prize acceptance speech, how he began to realize that, first of all, if he had delusions, he didn't use that term, but if he had delusions, he should stop talking about them. And then he realized, you know, when I have these strange ideas, I should just stop thinking them because it's a waste of my time. And so, you know, for the last 20 or so years of his life, he was near normal.
We're talking to neuroscientist and psychiatrist Nancy Andreasen. Now, you write about your leaving English literature to study medicine and psychiatry and the arts and artists, and you wrote after you had published a book, you were still in literature, and after you'd published a book about the poet John Donne, instead of feeling elated, I felt almost ashamed and self-indulgent. Who would this book help? What if I channeled the effort and energy I'd invested into a career that might save people's lives? Did the artists and writers that you studied also struggle with anything like that? Did you hear people questioning their own sense of usefulness and purpose when they were in the arts?
I would say in general, no. I think that somebody like, say, John Irving thoroughly enjoys what he does and feels that he is contributing, just contributing in a different way. I think most artists have that feeling. I may be just a little bit different because I've sometimes said I chose to have a career in literature before I had completely grown up and known who I was. I skipped three grades, and I got my PhD when I was only 20, 21. And it was only after, you know, that experience of becoming ill and nearly dying that I began to question my own personal utility in the world. And once I, you know, got into, when I took physics, for example, I realized this was a whole world that I had not learned anything about and that it was fascinating. Or put another way, I think that I have a brain that is quite ambidextrous because I'm good in the arts and the sciences, but I definitely have a brain that's tuned toward science.
Have you imaged your own brain?
Many times. Not lately. And yeah, I mean, one of the subtle rules of doing research is that you shouldn't do it to somebody else if you wouldn't be willing to do it to yourself. And so I've had my head in MR scanners and PET scanners many times.
What did you find? Was it instructive?
It wasn't really instructive, no. I found I had a brain. You know, as a matter of fact, though, when we did a PET scan of me, it's been a long time since we did that, but I was definitely odd in a way that most people weren't. I believe it was a what's known as the dichotic listening task, where you get competing sounds in both ears. And I think, as I recall, I processed sound that came to my right ear, for example, in both my right and my left auditory cortex and auditory association cortex, when most people don't. But anyway, and maybe that is an indication that I am sort of cognitively ambidextrous.
Now, you've studied, as you've mentioned, some amazing artists, Kurt Vonnegut, Neil Simon, George Lucas. What about, I found myself thinking there's so many artists who are just as dedicated and just as passionate and hardworking, but they're not very good artists. Do you have any sense of how they compare on a neuroscientific level and a brain level to some of these real, true, extraordinary geniuses?
That's a tough question. For one thing, I haven't studied artists who aren't very good, so I don't know how they would compare. Hypothetically, you might say that they have less well-developed association cortex, but I don't have a scientifically tested answer to that question.
What about risk-taking? What is the role of risk-taking in creativity, and is that something that can or should be cultivated?
It's definitely the case that people who are creative are more adventuresome and risk-taking. In general, there will, of course, always be exceptions to any generalization, but whether they're in the arts or the sciences, they kind of go out there to the edge and put themselves to the test. And, you know, that's just is a characteristic. The other part of your question was, should we be encouraging that more?
Yeah, for example, for young people in school, I think there's kind of an aversion to letting kids in school take risks.
I agree. I happen to have two grandchildren. They happen to be pretty bright and creative, and they happen to be lucky enough to be in schools that encourage that kind of exploratory adventuresomeness. But I think that many, many, many schools have a push for kids to be conventional, to do things in prescribed ways, and frown on getting too original, whether it's in math or whether it's in writing or whatever. I think that thinking about creativity has major implications for thinking about how we should be educating our children. And though there is some emphasis on that in, schools of education, there probably is not enough.
Yeah, you think about people like Steve Jobs, and you write about other people too, who are dropouts.
Yeah.
And maybe they wouldn't have dropped out if they'd had something to do that allowed them to really run with their creative impulses.
Yeah, I get asked to talk about creativity a lot, and that's one of the points I make. Some of our most prominent people, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, all three of them are college dropouts.
Now, the people you're mentioning, these are three men, and when we look at the kind of list of creative geniuses, there seems to be a lot more men than women. Is that true? What's going on?
I don't think that's true. You have to realize that women were not even allowed to go to college, let's just say in England, until early in the 20th century. Marie Curie, who is an example of a great creative woman, grew up in Poland. Women could not get doctoral degrees in Poland. They just were not allowed. She had to go to Paris, where she got her doctoral degree. And, of course, she was a rare example, even in Paris, when women were allowed to do doctoral degrees. So we've had a prejudice against encouraging women to be creative for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And we're just now at a time when women have had a chance to do things, and we're seeing the emergence of women who are creative or who are good leaders. But it only just began. When I went to med school, I was one of five or six women in a class of about 150. Now it's half and half, and we'll have to see what happens 50 years from now when there has been more opportunity for women.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting that there was any inherent thing, but rather that creativity really can be squelched by society if society tries hard enough.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Tell us the story about how Samuel Taylor Coleridge wrote Kubla Khan. It's such an interesting and telling story.
Well, he, you know, of course, was a romantic poet in the 19th century. And he also was, by the way, a college dropout. He had some health problems and maybe also was a bit of a hypochondriac. And back then, people who had complaints were often treated with opiates. And so he was out at a country retreat, and he was reading a book, a travelogue, called Pilgrimage by somebody named Purkis, and he'd been taking some opium, and he fell asleep. And while he was asleep, he composed 300 lines of poetry. And as he said, in that composition, these images rose up before his brain in crowds. And then he woke up, and he had these 300 lines of poetry in his mind, and he started writing them down, and there was a knock on the door, and he had to leave and go run an errand. And he came back, and he had lost everything except about, I don't know what, 40 lines. That's the story. I mean, it's really a little lesson in multiple things. The fact that creativity can occur at a preconscious level, as when he was basically drowsy, I guess, not sound asleep. And it was enhanced by drugs. In general, I don't think creativity is enhanced by drugs, and to suggest that is probably a dangerous thing to do. But it also, it's, I guess, just a matter of inspiration, and if the inspiration gets broken, you can lose original ideas.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking about with respect to that story was maybe the reframing of the idea of selfishness. I mean, sometimes artists are accused of being selfish or self-indulgent, but I look at that story and I think, if Coleridge had just been a little more selfish and told that guy to go away for a while, the guy who broke his process, we'd have a much longer poem.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. I, in general, I don't think artists are selfish. I mean, I've talked to now quite a lot of people who are successful creative people, and they're more altruistic than the average person by quite a lot.
Yeah.
They tend to have, you know, lots of social concerns, and they tend to act on them. Somebody like George Lucas is a huge advocate for education, for racial equality, just all kinds of things, and he builds that into his work.
Another thing that's really interesting about your work is that you write about IQ and creativity, and perhaps a little less so in the sciences, but in the arts, there's not really, I mean, super high IQ people aren't necessarily highly creative people, and highly artistically creative people don't necessarily have super high IQs. I mean, they're above average, but they're not sort of off the charts.
That's right, yeah. I've almost stopped using the word genius, because when you say genius, people think of high IQ, and the mean IQ in the workshop study was 120. And it is true, probably in this study I'm currently doing, that the scientists may have a somewhat higher IQ than the people from the arts. But creativity and high IQ are just two different things. They're maybe modestly related, but not closely related.
What does IQ tell us? Is there any helpfulness to that set of tests and scales?
Well, it's an indication of a person's ability to, I think, probably solve problems. Other than that, I can't say much. I know people, since I've tested a lot of people and know a lot about them, I just know that IQ tests are not highly predictive. And they're, I think, way overemphasized and way overvalued. And many of the leading people who are psychologists working in the area of intelligence would say exactly the same thing. Somebody like Howard Gardner talks about multiple intelligences and how we shouldn't be just basing our sense of intelligence on the ability to perform well on standard tests. It depends on what you mean by problem solving. If you mean the kind of thing that, say, Michael Faraday did when he was trying to understand the nature of electricity and magnetism, sure, a lot of science is about solving problems, seeing a question, saying, okay, how can I answer that question, and setting up the methods to do it. One of our tests in the creativity study we're currently doing is one which is a problem-solving test. And, well, we still don't have enough data really to say whether our creative people do better at the problem-solving than the non-creative or less creative. So I guess the answer is a partial yes.
I mean, there are some real differences from one person's creative process to another. I mean, there's the Coleridge example and a similar example from Mozart, who you quote as saying that he received musical pieces as one piece, and then it was kind of a process of transcribing it. And then for others, like Neil Simon, the creativity comes in the process of writing, and it's not whole at all. They don't know how it's going to come out until the end. So it's not like there's really seemingly multiple creative processes that you found.
Yeah, that's actually true, and that's a very good point to make, and it's not one I've made that all that much. So congratulations on thinking of that.
Well, and the other thing is that these creative moments that people have, which can't be forced, but they happen the more work you do and the more you show up and so on, mm-hmm. are blissful. Why do you think it's creativity is just so blissful for the creator?
I don't know. I guess it's just that it is. I wrote this article for Atlantic Magazine, which you may or may not have seen, but one of the people happened to be a physicist. At the end of the interview, I tape record the interviews. At the end of the interview, he said, "There's one more thing I want to say, but I don't want you to record it." And then he said, "You know, doing good science is like having good sex. It just feels wonderful." And, you know, he was a physicist, kind of nerdy and shy, and I think he knew it was going to be transcribed, and he didn't want my secretary to hear him saying that. But it is a feeling that a lot of people have when they solve a problem, think of a good problem, have the perfect sentence written. It is joyous, blissful.
Well, I was thinking of it in terms of, and this is just, I mean, completely off the top of my head. I mean, I have no way of knowing whether there's any truth to this, but I was thinking about our hunter-gatherer ancestors and this moment where somebody comes up with the wheel or the arrow or a new way to make something. There's some bliss associated with that because there's so much it's like survival advantage to coming up with new things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. Nothing really I can add to that.
Well, you have written about the importance, I mean, you come from both literature and science, and the importance of studying a lot of different disciplines. How do you think that the sciences and the arts could be brought together for students, for young people, for students in college, in a way that would really strengthen those people's minds and the disciplines themselves?
Well, it's hard to talk about how to operationalize that, but I would say that, you know, there is a tendency to encourage people to specialize relatively early and to track people. And I guess having been a victim of that myself and having gotten on the wrong track initially, I would say tracking is not a good thing. I think that the whole idea of the liberal arts, truly liberal arts, or liberal arts and sciences, is really the best thing for kids in high school and in college. I should never have been allowed to graduate from college without taking physics, for example. Mm-hmm. Just, I shouldn't.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, it's just about time to go. Is there anything else that you would like to add before we do?
I would just say that the things you were just talking about, how to shape the best education for young people, whether it's in junior high, high school, or university, is something that we really need to be thinking about, and particularly for people who either have not come from an enriched environment or people who you know, maybe have, well, people from various disadvantaged backgrounds, because there have to be a lot of creative geniuses out there in the world who are not being found.
Yeah.
And one of the, you know, one of the crucial problems is to find those people and help them.
I mean, one can't help but think that we'd have a much happier and more vibrant society if people's creative genius or just normal creativity were able to be channeled and expressed.
Yes, I would agree. I mean, you talked about the blissfulness of doing something creative. And I would also say, by the way, that we shouldn't diminish the importance of ordinary creativity. Just as an example, I love to cook, and I love to cook creatively and make up new recipes and things like that. And there are many opportunities like that in everyday life to do things that are creative and joyous and blissful and rewarding. So we shouldn't be thinking that, sure, there's a George Lucas or a Neil Simon, and that's the pinnacle, and we can't share in that pinnacle, because people can't.
Yeah, I mean, it's not... You show some graphs of the bell-shaped curve, and creativity doesn't seem to be exactly the bell-shaped curve, but there is a continuum between the kind of creativity that normal people experience, like cooking, or what they do in their gardens, or the way they use language in daily life, and the kind of extreme creativity. They're maybe of a different degree, but not of a different kind. Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Nancy Andreasen, for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you at the James A. Little Theater tomorrow night.
Thank you. Nice talking with you.
Nancy Andreasen is a neuroscientist and psychiatrist. She's Andrew H. Wood's Chair of Psychiatry and Director of the Neuroimaging Research Center and the Mental Health Clinical Research Center at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. And once again, she will be speaking tomorrow night, Wednesday, the 15th of July, at 7:30 in the evening at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe. The lecture is called Understanding Genius, the Neuroscience of Extraordinary Creativity. It's sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute and is free and open to the public.